gun!
Guns aren't toys. They're for family protection, hunting dangerous or delicious animals, keeping the King of England out of your face.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. Is the problem.
Here's a hint for you geniuses out there.
Avenge me! Avenge me!
It's all for nothing if you don't have freedom.
It's all that cheese they eat. Seems like every other day somebody's rolling a 50-pound cheese wheel.
Put out all points bulletin. We'll set him roadblocks everywhere.
A new world order. A new world order.
Attention. Attention.
Government is
an emergency. Repeat. An emergency.
I'm not going to stand for this. I'm going to call the newspapers, the TV stations, the gas stations, everybody.
Heavens. What kind of radio show is this?
Sit back down and shut your trap. It's time for
Dutch Jones. Dutch Jones.
Radio program.
And now for something completely different.
Hi-de-ho, listeners.
You're listening to Stronghold Radio. That's right, that's what we call it, Stronghold Radio, because this is our stronghold, where we are here in Cahuilla, K-A-W-E-A-H, California. Why does that sound so weird? You can hear the fan and stuff in the background. Let me turn it down a little bit here. Let me turn the gain down, turn this back up. Does that sound better? I hope it does. Thank you for tuning in on this, a Wednesday, the 1st. Oh, you get to tear the little calendar off, Debbie's calendar she donated. Here you go. You ready? You ready? You ready, Debbie? Here we go. June. Ah, there we go. June 1st, Wednesday, 2011. I am Dutch Jones. This is the Dutch Jones Radio Program. It is Wednesday, and we are live at about 5:04 p.m. specific time. We don't have a whole lot of people tuning in right now, but that's okay. We're going to do a show anyway. I want to welcome all of our podcast people who listen later in the evening, our people who listen off the embedded players, folks on Facebook, MySpace, and everywhere else that you listen. I just thank you so much for being part of the Stronghold Radio family and sharing it with others. It's always a good feeling when I get emails from people that I don't see in the chat room, because there's about a 9 to 12 people that regularly check in every day, and we appreciate that, that tune in for whatever the blathering Dutch Jones is going to share. And we thank you for tuning in, so I really like it when other folks tune in. We've been having a good day today, working on vehicles, researching. We didn't do a whole lot of work today. It's just fighting this cold. I guess now, you know, it's still a spring cold. It won't be summer till a few more days, I guess. And Stacy's doing good. She's doing the Dayquil. I'm just fighting it. I was up all night. I couldn't sleep. But my voice is better. And so we're just having a good time. Did we do anything special today? What'd you do, Lou? Nothing, huh? We did nothing today. You had a pizza omelet for breakfast. That's what Lou did, yeah. That's just the way it goes. We don't know if maybe we're having connection problems or something. I know that there have been some cyber attacks going on the internet today around everywhere. So that's okay. We'll do the show for who's here. I've got some interesting articles that have come up. One is just furious, and I'll start with that one. There's the last article I read before coming on the air, and it's about San Francisco public safety, or so-called public safety. Now, there's always this perception that everybody wants to hero worship police and fire. I've worked in both, and I'm here to tell you they're not worthy of hero worship. There are individuals that from time to time take their job seriously and are worthy of praise, but normally they do it because they are drawn to that type of work. The pay is excellent. The benefits are outrageous. And they're not heroes. They're guys doing their job. They spend most of their time training, hour after hour, sitting around doing astronaut training. Anybody who's been a firefighter knows what that is. That means sitting in a recliner watching training videos or possibly just HBO. That doesn't mean they're bad fellas, but they're no more heroes to me than the guy who goes and punches the clock every day and takes care of his family in a mine or at a garage or at a grocery store. And one thing that really bothers me about public safety employees is that they all belong to unions, at least all the ones I've met. And union rules, city rules, policies, you know, they're not going to bend from those rules because they don't want to risk losing their benefits or their job or promotions. So they do everything that they're told to do, like good little puppets. And the union comes first, not the public. not even themselves sometimes, but their retirement at 55 for fire if you're in California, and different things like that. So whether it's a highway patrolman, ambulance, I don't know if most ambulance drivers aren't union. Most of the ones I met are private sector. But here, handcuffed. This is from The Lookout. It's a Yahoo News blog. Dated today at 3:20 p.m., and I just read it moments before I came on. The author is Zachary Roth, and the headline is, Handcuffed by Policy, Fire and Police Crews Watch a Man Drown. Don't you love that title? An apparently suicidal man waded into San Francisco Bay on Monday, stood up to his neck, and waited. As the man drowned, police and fire crews and others watched idly from the shore. Why, you may ask? Officials blamed a departmental policy stemming from budget cuts that prevented them from jumping in the water to save him. That's right. They had rules against firemen getting wet. 50-year-old Raymond Zack, Z-A-C-K, spent nearly an hour in the water before drowning. Probably succumbed to hypothermia, and the bay is just freezing. A crowd of about 75 people, who I blame them to, in addition to first responders, watched from the beach in Alameda across the bay from San Francisco as Zach inched further and further away, sometimes glancing back. Talk about a call for help. A witness told the San Jose Mercury News, the next thing we noticed, he was floating face down. Now, a volunteer eventually pulled Zach's lifeless body from the bay. Volunteer, they probably mean a citizen. Now, Mike DiOrazzi of the Alameda Fire Department said that due to 2009 budget cuts, his crew lacked the training and gear to enter the water, and a Coast Guard boat couldn't access the area because the water was too shallow. So because they didn't have cold weather gear, water gear, swift water rescue gear. Now, how many times have we seen these stories, you know, anywhere but San Francisco, of course, where firemen risk their lives to go into raging water to save kids? Now, I'm not always saying that's the smartest thing to do, so don't get me wrong there. But because these guys didn't have exactly everything that they needed, they refused to go in. But at a city council hearing Tuesday night, some locals expressed outrage that Zach was left to die. This just strikes me as not just a problem with funding, but a problem with the culture of what's going on in our city, that no one should take the time to help this drowning man, said one resident named Adam Gallit. Alameda Police Lieutenant Sean Lynch also suggested his men did the right thing, because police stood by too. He was engaged in a deliberate act of taking his own life, Lynch told the Mercury News. We did not know whether he was violent, whether drugs were involved. It's not a situation of a typical rescue. The city said it would spend up to $40,000 to certify 16 firefighters in a land-based water rescue class. One witness at the event told a local news station that Zach was looking at the people on the shore. We expected to see at some point that there would be concern for him, said another, but there wasn't. Now, we can get into the whole point of, you know, letting the gene pool thin itself out. The guy wants to commit suicide. Why take the risk? But the whole purpose of public safety is what? It's right there, public safety. They take an oath to do these things, and because they didn't have a wetsuit, a line of rope, they had 75 people standing by. Why not ask them to link arms and go in the water and rescue this guy? Now, you got to remember, San Francisco is busy with things like passing laws to ban circumcision, passing laws to say that it's illegal to lay down anywhere in the city, passing laws saying that only politicians can carry guns, but yet they weren't willing to spend $40,000 to make sure that 16 firefighters would be certified in water rescues. It's typical, and it's not just because it's a liberal city. I've seen this kind of thing in other places. I've told you the story of the fire marshal who was almost fired from the city of Moreno Valley because he rushed into a burning house to save babies. But yet the rules were you have to have two firefighters outside and two inside to execute a search and rescue. But this firefighter knew that the children wouldn't last because of the type of fire that it was and how fast it was raging against the building. He ran in and he was a hero in the press, but almost got fired for it and was reprimanded. Union rules, staffing rules, OSHA rules. It's ridiculous, isn't it? It's ridiculous. But also, look at the people on the shore. What would have happened if those 75 people had said, no, we're going in, and they locked arms when he was only in neck-deep water? Now, they don't say the guy's 12 feet tall or 5 feet tall, so we don't know the particulars in this case. But it's ridiculous to think that someone could die within a few feet, let's say 100 feet, of of rescue workers and civilians. Now, this is, you hear stories about this all the time. The young woman in Boston who was repeatedly raped and stabbed to death. Well, a whole neighborhood just turned an ear to it. The callousness that we have towards human life, the refusal to take part because we don't want to break laws. It shows how well our people are conditioned. Our firefighters, our policemen, and even our Coast Guard. They couldn't bring in their boat, their craft, because it was too, the shore was, it was too shallow where he was. But they couldn't bring in a smaller craft. They couldn't deploy life-saving jackets and throw them at the guy. Somebody couldn't run to a hardware store and get a rope. It's weird to me that they would allow this man to drown in the bay without batting an eye and just saying, well, the rules say we can't rescue him. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know the ethnicity of the guy. They say his name was Zach. I don't know if he was African-American. I don't know if he was an immigrant. I don't know if he was a white guy. I don't know why they would just simply stand by. But it's a problem that you see that is pervasive in our public safety employees. So next time you start going, oh, God bless our firemen, police, and ambulance drivers, our EMTs, remember what they're really doing. They're serving their union bosses. They're serving their own hide. It is the exception, not the rule, that they bend over backwards to save a life. We've got a story going on right now in Fresno here that's the opposite of it. A known carjacker was seen running from a car towards a grocery store. So a police officer jumps up and shot him in the back while he was fleeing. And they're saying it's justified because they feared that he was going to go into the grocery store and take hostages, even though they saw no weapon. They I guess they can read minds. So now it's getting to the point, like, you know, where they can read your mind. We think he's going to take hostages, so I'm going to shoot him in the back. So it's weird to me that you see this diversity in the dereliction of duty, that they would do this type of thing. And you're going to see more of it as the economy gets worse. There's going to be a dereliction of duty in rescue. We've been told up here that we only have 3 firefighters for our fire station, but when I go over there, there's only 1 firefighter. I still don't understand. Are there 2 on call that live in the community, perhaps? But there's only 1 firefighter there, and it's always interesting to me that they get away with that, but yet our taxes keep going up. Our code enforcement keeps going up. Policy enforcement keeps going up. They keep saying they don't have enough money, but yet they keep taking more money from us. Right now, if a seatbelt fine in California for a child, I think it was under 16 years of age, is $400. If Lou here doesn't have his seatbelt on, we get a $400 fine. And I don't know where that money's going. I don't know what they're doing with it. But surely San Francisco could have afforded $40,000 to send their... I can't even imagine a city the size of San Francisco not having water rescue trained people. That's just a conspiracy on a grand scale. They have a major bay. They have a naval installation. They have I don't know. I guess a lot of the tourism that goes on is state parks related and Coast Guard related. But at least the city buffers these things. So it surprises me that they wouldn't have done that. I mean, heads should roll for this. If it were my community, I would be at that council meeting every time they had a meeting and say, okay, where's the accountability here? Who's going to get fired for this? Which one of you idiots said we're not going to spend $40,000 to train water rescue in a city on a bay? It's even known as Gay Bay. Come on. It's, you know, San Francisco by the sea. Come on. And they're not going to train their people. Even Los Angeles has multiple swift water rescue teams. Los Angeles. Desert communities. I know desert communities in San Bernardino County and Riverside County that have swift water rescue teams because of flash flooding in brief moments of the season, but yet they are smart enough to train their firemen. And their tax bases are much smaller than San Francisco. So it's a prime example of what we preach here at Stronghold Radio. Do not count on government to save you. Now, this guy was committing suicide. The only thing that would have made this worse if it had been a child that had fallen in. Now, think about it. We've had 2 teenagers jump from the Golden Gate Bridge, and both of them were rescued by private citizens. Now I know why. I was always curious why in the last 6 months we heard about two teenagers either falling or deliberately jumping from the Golden Gate Bridge, not to commit suicide, but on a dare the idiot did it. And they were rescued, one by surfers, sailboarders or something, and the other one was by private citizen boaters. And I was like, wow, that's kind of weird. You'd think there'd be a guy on duty under the Golden Gate Bridge in a dinghy with a rope and a life rescue system. But now I know why. Most people that jump off the bridge have to be rescued by citizens, because public safety is neither public nor safe. It has nothing to do with it. And they're more busy. Well, the fire department's out writing fines for you not having the right grease vent over your business's grill, fines for not having the right fuses or wiring. They're doing all that to be policy enforcers and fee generators, rather than learning the craft of actually saving lives. Because I'm here to tell you, police and firemen don't fight fires as much as you would think. It's mostly medical calls, transporting old ladies and old men to the emergency room because they didn't take their medication or they pushed too hard in the morning bowel movement. Dead serious. Automobile accidents, things like that. They don't fight fires, but yet they train constantly for fighting fires. And vehicle extractions and things like that. But whatever's in their area of operations, they need to be experts on that. And it's just another example of how the myth versus reality. The myth versus reality. I've got another article here. Let me see what I got. I've got some good articles today. Some stuff that's really kind of creepy, too. I got a video here. Maybe I'll post it. Maybe I won't. In Syria, the police arrested a 13-year-old boy during the protests there. Took him to their police station and filleted him over parts of his body. It looks like from the video, I can't understand the language, but from what I've seen of translations of what people have posted, they stuck knives under his skin and tortured him. They beat him to death, basically, but they shot him in the chest and then dumped him on his parents' front lawn. And there's a video posted. Let's see. I don't know if I click on this, will that be the link, Lou? Right-click that. Yeah. Copy link. Now, this is very graphic. And I don't recommend if you have a weak stomach to watch it, but this is the kind of thing you need to see. And I'm putting it in there. So if you go onto YouTube and just put in 13-year-old Syrian boy murdered by police or beaten by police. Now, Hillary's all up in arms about this. It didn't make it a link, Lou. Well, that's kind of weird, but you guys can cut and paste it. Where am I here? Dun, 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 dun. Okay, make sure I'm not closing the wrong thing. Do this. And it's just the brutality against a 13-year-old boy. Now, I don't know what the 13-year-old boy was doing. I don't know if he was a suicide bomber. I don't know if he was throwing stones. But he's a 13-year-old Muslim boy. Now, the Muslims are fighting Muslims in Syria. Armor's out. RPGs are out. It's a full-on civil war in Syria in these, like, four or five different communities. I don't get television news. I get radio news. I've heard nothing about it on the radio. The only reason I get it is I look up French, German, European news. I even look at Al Jazeera and I see what's going on. This is Muslim on Muslim violence. They're different factions. It's not Shia versus Shiite. It's something I've never even heard of. I don't remember the name. Some gobbledygook. If this is what they do to their own 13-year-old children in Syria in a civil war, imagine how much more fierce and barbaric they're going to be against Westerners. And are. I mean, facts are there. They already do what they do. So I encourage you, if you've got a strong stomach, to take a look at the video and to see what they do to their own. I get a lot of grief from people when I talk about the Confederacy. And believe it or not, it's not people that are anti-Confederate. It's the pro-Confederates. They can't believe that someone in California, someone born in Boston, Massachusetts, raised in Colorado, served in the United States Army, occupied at Fort McClellan, Fort Benning, Fort A.P. Hill, Fort George G. Meade, yeah, Maryland was still, and would be a Confederate. They think I'm a big phony. I get a lot of emails. Especially, and then when they go, you're in California, there's no way. Well, I was doing some research on stuff that I'm going to talk about in the second half hour about a local hero who's buried here that I found. Not Civil War, but we went to the gravesite on Memorial Day in the community cemetery, because we only have 10 or so people buried in ours, and I know who they are, so we went down to the community cemetery to look at the war dead that were there, and it goes all the way back to the Civil War and even before. I think some of the oldest graves were like 1840s up there, people that died in the 1840s. But I looked up the history of California Civil War, And strangely enough, the two counties that I've lived in most of my time here in California, I lived 15 years in San Bernardino County, and the last 4 or 5 years here in Tulare County, were both seditionist counties. They actually wanted to secede from California in these counties, a big chunk of Southern California, and they wanted to be known as Colorado. You got to realize this is before Colorado became a state in 1876. They wanted to secede with Oregon and start what was known as Colorado. Now, I know Warland's not in there. He's always talking about Jefferson. Colorado was known as Jefferson Territory at that time. So when they chose Colorado, there were a lot of California Mexicans, Spaniards, Americans, Europeans that were pro-Confederacy. They had a lot of problems with it, and there was a lot of confrontations. There were actual militias back then, the California Territorial Militias. Several of them went Confederate, and they had to be disarmed by bigger militias. Some of them lied, took the ironclad oath, kept their weapons, and then snuck out, attacked Fort Yuma, made it to Texas, and joined the fight there. There were actually pirates. The Knights of the Golden Circle, which you know some of you know as the precursor to the Ku Klux Klan, I don't know if that's necessarily true of all of them, but the Knights of the Golden Circle came over here and were attempting to capture ships to become privateers. They got letters of marque from Jefferson Davis to attack Union vessels that were carrying gold and silver around South America. And those folks came from Tulare County, where I'm at right now, and San Bernardino County, and a few of the Alamitos, a couple other places. I was completely amazed at doing it. Now, I had heard stories about little groups. There was actually a group of Confederates here, let me open this article, that were raiding known Unionist sympathizers and taking the gold and silver and whatever they made and sending it to the war effort for the Confederacy. There were actual raids, not less than 10 miles from where I'm living right now, where they were raiding ranches and things that were supporting the Union and taking that the booty from that and sending it to the Confederacy. Now, patriotic fervor swept California after the attack on Fort Sumter. Now, you got to realize this is written with a Unionist point of view. I'm just finding the facts in there. Providing the manpower for volunteer regiments recruited mainly from pro-Union counties in the north of the state. And that funny Northern California went with Northern United States. When the Democratic Party split over the war, Republican supporters of Lincoln took control of the state in the September elections. Volunteer regiments were sent to occupy pro-secessionist Southern California and Tulare County, where I'm sitting right now, leaving them generally powerless during the war itself. However, some Southerners traveled east to join the Confederate Army, avoiding Union patrols and hostile Apache. Others remaining in the state attempted to outfit a privateer to prey on coastal shipping, and late in the war, two groups of partisan rangers were formed. Now, I love that. There were groups of partisan rangers that actually attacked Union interests here in California. When California was admitted to the state under the Compromise of 1850, Californians had already decided to be a free state, non-slave. The Constitutional Convention of 1849 unanimously abolished slavery. As a result, Southerners in Congress voted against admission in 1850 while Northerners pushed it through, pointing to its population of 93,000 and its vast wealth in gold. So the Northerners knew what they were doing. Now, following California's admission to the Union, Californios, that's what the locals called themselves, Californios, dissatisfied with inequitable taxes and land laws, don't you love it, and pro-slavery Southerners in lightly populated rural Southern California attempted three times in the 1850s to achieve a separate statehood or territorial status from Northern California. Now, the last attempt, the PICO Act, P-I-C-O, of 1859, was passed by the California State Legislature, signed by the state governor, John B. Weller, approved overwhelmingly by voters in the proposed territory of Colorado. See, they actually seceded at the state level. And we're going to be allowed to call Southern California Colorado. They sent it to Washington, D.C. with a strong advocate in Senator Milton Latham. However, the secession crisis followed the election of Lincoln in 1860 led to the proposal never coming to a vote at the congressional level, at the federal level. In 1860, California gave a small plurality of 38,000 votes to Abraham Lincoln, whose 32% of the total vote was enough to win all of its electoral votes. Lincoln only got 32% of California's votes. So 68% of people in California voted for the other three candidates, which, of course, you should remember were Stephen A. Douglas, John C. Breckinridge, and John Bell. Now, Breckinridge was the Southern Democrat that was running. The other were Constitutional Unionists, Northern Democrats, things like that. Now, during the secession crisis following Lincoln's election, federal troops were under the command of Colonel Albert Sidney Johnston in Benicia, headquarters of the Department of the Pacific, and General Johnston strongly believed in the Southern right to secede, but followed orders anyway. And until he was betrayed by the Union government, he told the Southerners and Confederates in the area that if you attack San Francisco or any of the armories, I will defend them, because I'm a soldier first, and the Union still, you know, I still serve it. But he was replaced because local politicians, landowners, and Union sympathizers said they didn't trust him, so he was kicked out. So then he joined the other side and became part of the partisan Rangers. Meanwhile, Union men feared that Johnston would aid such a plot and communicated that their fears to Washington, asking him to be replaced. Then Brigadier General Edwin Voss Sumner was soon sent west via Panama. He came across land before the canal was there to replace Johnston in March of 61. That's 1861. So at the secession crisis, as the secession crisis developed in early 1861, oh, wow, that went quick. We're going to talk more about this. California was a hotbed of secessionism, and I want to keep educating you folks on that. We'll be right back after this break on Stronghold Radio.
Old politics of race or slavery. Those who see no more than that care not for history. For our hearts are still with Jackson and our faith in General Lee. And we still can taste the sweetness of that one last victory. Though we'll never ride with Forrest and we'll never march with Bragg, we still love our Southern heroes and we love our Southern flag. It's a way of life that ended and the way it died so hard. It's the honor and the chivalry folks today most disregard. It's the ride around McClellan and New Market's young cadets. It's Sam Watkins telling stories and Sam Davis's regrets. And our hearts are still with Stuart and our faith in General Lee. And we still can taste the sweetness of that one last victory. No, we'll never march with Johnston or be caught with General Bragg. We will love our Southern heroes and we love our Southern flag. It's the dream of picket charging and never being stopped. It's the thought of Stonewall Jackson never being shot. Though it never change America, she is as she should be. We can't help but try once more to win that one last victory. For our hearts are still with Jackson and our faith in General Lee. And we still can taste the sweetness of that one last victory. No, we'll never march with Claiborne or be stuck with General Bragg. We will love our Southern heroes and we love our Southern flag. For our hearts are still with Longstreet and our faith in General Lee. We still think we're good enough to win that one last victory. Time won't let us march with Early or be wasted by old Bragg. But we'll flaunt our Southern birthright and we'll wave our Southern flag.
When the crash does come, when there is a natural disaster, during civil unrest, the last thing you want to be is a refugee. So check out DutchJones.info. That's www.dutchjones.info.
We have the supplies you need and the information you will need. That's www.dutchjones.info.
Welcome back. You're listening to, you're tuned into, you've dialed up Stronghold Radio, coming to you from Cahuilla, California, Central California, where there are Confederates. There were Confederates. There will always be Confederates. There will be seditionists. The cause lives on all throughout America, so, you know, whenever you get Southerners who strongly hold that it's a boundary-exclusive cause, I try to correct them. I get a lot of grief for it, and I'm just trying to bring up some historical facts right now. That song even mentioned Johnston. Johnston was replaced, as I said before the break here, and he turned over and became part of the, I think it was the California Mounted Rifles, which was a Confederate militia. And he made it to Texas, joined, fought. He was made a general in the Confederate military, and unfortunately we lost him at the Battle of Shiloh. So he was a Californian. He may not have been born in California, but he came from California with a banjo on his knee, and fought for the holy cause of liberty for the Confederacy. And I could go on and on about it, and I may save this section for another day. I thought I'd have more time because I've got somebody that I've just got to talk about. So, but I hope I got the point across. Don't think just because I am in California that we are not part of the holy cause of liberty. Now, I told you guys Monday that I went to... I guess I told you yesterday that Monday I went to the Three Rivers Cemetery. I was looking for, I had heard that there were several burials over there, 6 to 9 people that had fought in the Boer Wars. And I didn't know if they were going to be Dutch, you know, fighters or English fighters. They turned out to be all English, but that's okay. You know, even though the official policy is we hate England, I can, historically, I can understand why they chose to fight for England instead of, you know, my ancestors, the Dutch, because they weren't Dutch. But I ran across a grave of a person named Frederick Russell Burnham. Now, this guy, I'm just going to start off here and let you know this. This guy, he was the inspiration for Boy Scouts of America. Robert Baden-Powell, who started the Boy Scouts, was trained by Frederick Russell Burnham, and this guy, and he's an amazing man. He was the inspiration for Indiana Jones and a couple other of those old serial films from the 40s and 50s about adventures. This guy was a warrior, an archaeologist, a geologist, an oil man, a gold miner, a spy, started businesses. He was a writer. And he was an amazing man, and he lived here in Cahuilla Three Rivers. They had a big ranch. His family had a huge ranch in the 1800s up on South Fork. It's still there today. We drove up by it today. I forgot to point it out to the family, but I was going up there to look to see where it was. Now, Frederick Russell Burnham, he was born May 11th, 1861, and he died September 1st, 1947. He was an American scout and world-traveling adventurer known for his service to the British Army in colonial Africa and for teaching woodcraft to Robert Baden-Powell, thus becoming one of the inspirations for the founding of the International Scouting Movement. Burnham had little formal education, attending high school but never graduating. He dropped out at age 14, went to the American Southwest, and became a tracker in the U.S. Army and fought in the Apache Wars. He was successful in that, fighting in the campaigns against Geronimo, went to North to fight the Cheyenne Wars, and this is at age 14. The guy's, and it goes later into what he looks like. He's like 5'4", piercing blue eyes. I mean, I'm looking at his picture here in his British military uniform, and he just, and why there aren't a ton of movies about this guy, I don't know. Sensing the Old West was getting too tame, as an adult, Burnham went to Africa where his background proved useful. He soon became an officer in the British Army, serving in several battles there. During this time, Burnham became friends with Baden-Powell and passed on to him both his outdoor skills and his spirit for what would later become known as scouting. Burnham eventually moved on to become involved in espionage, oil, conservation efforts, writing, and business. His descendants are still active in scouting today. Burnham was born to a missionary family on an Indian reservation in Tivoli, Minnesota. As a toddler, he witnessed the burning of New Ulm, Minnesota, by Teotihuacan, Little Crow, and his Sioux warriors in the Dakota War of 1862. He was only 2 years old. During the uprising, his mother, Rebecca Russell Burnham, hid the not-quite-two-year-old boy in a basket of green corn husks and fled for her life. Once the Sioux had been driven away, the mother returned to find her house and belongings burned, but her young son was safe, fast asleep in a basket protected only by corn husks. The young Burnham attended schools in Iowa, and there he met Blanche Blick, who's also buried over here, who would later become his wife. His family moved to Los Angeles, California in 1870. 2 years later, his father, the Reverend Edwin Otay Burnham of Kentucky, himself a longtime pioneer and missionary along the border of Ho-Chunk, the Winnebago Indian Reservation in Minnesota, died when Burnham was only 12. While his mother and his then 3-year-old baby brother Howard Burnham returned to Iowa, the young Burnham stayed in California to make his own way. Can you imagine that? 12 years old. No, Mom, you go back, live with Grandma. I'm staying here in California. I'm making a man out of myself. Now, I'm not belittling Lou's generation or even our generation, but I moved out when I was 15 and made a life for myself working as a radio DJ. Now, compare that to a 12-year-old going into 1870s California. For the next 3 years, Burnham worked as a mounted messenger for the Western Union Telegraph Company in California and Arizona. On one occasion, his horse was stolen from him by Tiburcio Vasquez, I don't know if I'm saying that right, a famous California bandit. At age 14, he began his life as a scout and Indian tracker in the Apache Wars. He traveled in northern Mexico and in the American Southwest, including Texas and Oklahoma, earning a living as a buffalo hunter, cowboy, and prospector, and he continued working as a scout while tracking Indians in the Cheyenne War. The young Burnham eventually went on to attend high school in California but never graduated. Yeah, who needs, you know, you don't need a high school diploma to be an Indian hunter. In 1882, Burnham returned to Arizona and was appointed deputy sheriff of Pinal County. He soon went back to cattle and mining interests. He joined the losing side of the Tonto Basin feud before mass killing started and only narrowly escaped death in Arizona. So he was a gunfighter, too. He returned to Prescott, Iowa, to visit his childhood sweetheart, Blanche, and the two were married on February 6, 1884. That same year, he and Blanche settled down to tend an orange grove in Pasadena, California, but within a year, he was back prospecting and scouting. This guy had wanderlust. Amazing stuff. Now, he ends up in the 1880s. Let's see. I'm going to get through this. He ends up in Rhodesia. The work of Cecil Rhodes in, you know, starting Rhodesia, the gold mining and everything that was going on there. He set sail in 1893 to Cape Town, South Africa, with his wife and young son. He soon joined the British South African Company as a scout and headed north. Burnham became well known in Africa for his ability to track, even at night, and the Africans dubbed him He Who Sees in the Dark. Burnham is the brother of Matthew Howard Burnham, a mining engineer and spy, and second cousin of Lieutenant Howard Matthew Burnham, who was killed in the American Civil War, also a note here. Now, he fought in several wars in Africa, and most notably, his family was laid siege to while he was out in battle, and his toddler daughter, who was 3 years old, died of hunger because she was stuck in a city behind the walls while African tribes laid siege to it, and he couldn't get to her. Well, when he found out about this, he hunted down the chief of the tribe, laid in wait in his cave, and when he appeared, he shot him through the heart. Him and another guy did this and fought off 100 of these African tribesmen to get away and survived. Now, he's most notable. He's done all these battles. He was in Northern Rhodesian Wars, the Matabele War, tons of stuff. You got to look this guy up. There needs to be a movie about this guy. But he was on something called the Shangani Patrol, where he and two others were the only ones that survived this huge battle, and he received all kinds of medals for it. And what's interesting about this guy is not only was he a warrior, he went to Alaska for the Klondike Gold Rush. He fought in the Second Boer War, which, well, you know, I'll have to hold a grudge against him because he fought against my ancestors. But this guy never stopped exploring. He became an amateur archaeologist. He found all kinds of things in Mexico that were, until he got there, you know, they couldn't find them.
and he discovered them. He's responsible for cultural resource discoveries. So also just to note, he was the highest decorated American in the British military. He got so many injuries and he was wounded so many times, he was ordered back to England by Lord Roberts. 2 days before leaving for London, he was promoted to the rank of major. On his arrival in England, Burnham was commanded to dine with Queen Victoria and to spend the night at the Osborne House. A few months later, after the Queen's death, King Edward VII personally presented Burnham with the Queen's South Africa Medal with four bars for the battles that he fought in at Driefontein, Johannesburg, Paardeberg, and Cape Colony, in addition to the Cross of the Distinguished Service Order, the second highest decoration in the British Army for his heroism in the victorious march to Pretoria, which occurred the first week in June 1900. Burnham had been selected for the Victoria Cross, British highest military award, but he declined rather than forfeit his American citizenship. That was one thing. To get their highest medal, he had to become a Brit, and he didn't want to. Nevertheless, Burnham received the highest awards of any American who ever served in the British military. Burnham's most accomplished soldiers during the Second Boer War were the Lovat Scouts, a Scottish Highland regiment, which I've heard about, the Lovat, L-O-V-A-T, who he described as half wolf and half jackrabbit. The Scouts were well practiced in the art of marksmanship, fieldcraft, and tactics. After the war, this regiment went on to become the British Army's first sniper unit. And this guy lived here where I'm living now, and he did all these things. I mean, there's just a ton of stuff here. After recovering from his wounds, Burnham served in the London office manager for the WA Syndicate. I don't know what that is. In 1901, while still employed by these folks, he left London to lead an expedition through Ghana and Upper Volta to look for minerals and ways to improve river navigation in the region. From 1902 to 1904, Burnham was employed by the East Africa Syndicate. He led a mineral prospecting expedition which traveled extensively in the area around Lake Rudolph, now Lake Turkana, and he discovered a lake of carbonate soda in Tanzania. So, I guess carbonated soda, we have to thank him for it. Let's see. He worked in Mexico in the Yaqui River project. And the thing is, you look through this, the guy never stayed still. Never stayed still. You look at the things that he's done. And again, 5'4", little guy. I picture if Robert Conrad was still, you know, in his prime, he could probably play him. let's see. He fought in the Mexican Revolution in the state of Sonora. He found archaeological things for the Guggenheim and snuck them back. And this is probably where the Indiana Jones thing came from. And then in 1917, Mexico passed laws prohibiting the sale of land to foreigners, so he left. And they had to sell their properties back to Mexico. Now, here's where it gets good again. During World War I, Burnham was living in California and was active in counter-espionage for Britain. Much of it involved the famous Boer spy, Captain Fritz Hubert Duskane, and if I'm pronouncing that wrong, I apologize to his family, who became a German spy in both World Wars and claimed to have killed Field Marshal Kitchener while en route to meet with the Russians. During the Second Boer War, Burnham and Duskane were each under orders to assassinate each other if they ever met. But it was not until 1910 that the two men first met while both in Washington, D.C., separately lobbying Congress to pass a bill in favor of the importation of African game animals into the United States, which was H.R. 23621. Duskane was twice arrested by the FBI, and in 1942, he, along with 32 other Nazi agents who made up the Duskane spy ring, was sent to prison for espionage in the largest spy ring ever caught in U.S. history. During this period, Burnham was one of the 18 officers selected by former U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt to raise a volunteer infantry division for service in France in 1917, shortly after the United States entered the war. A plan to raise volunteer soldiers from the Western U.S. came out of a meeting with the New York-based Rocky Mountain Club, and Burnham was put in charge of both the general organization and recruitment of the Southwest Congress and gave Roosevelt the authority to raise up to four divisions similar to the Rough Riders. Isn't that amazing? When they got there, Woodrow Wilson refused their service. Isn't that typical? They go out and they organize a militia. Teddy Roosevelt's involved and they refuse it. Now, this guy at 5'4" tall. That's about what you are, Lou, aren't you? 5'5"?
No.
How tall are you? 5'3". You're 5'3", so he's just an inch taller than Lou. He had a slight build, but he was also muscular and bronze with a finely formed square jaw. He had a boyish appearance, which he used to his advantage on numerous occasions. His most noticeable feature was his steady gray-blue eyes. Contemporary reports had it that Burnham's gaze appeared to never leave those of the person he was looking at, and yet somehow could simultaneously monitor all the details of the physical surroundings. It was also said that Burnham's eye possessed a faraway look, such as those acquired by people whose occupation has caused them to watch continually at sea or on the Great Plains. Burnham would not smoke or seldom drank alcohol, fearing these habits would injure the acuteness of his sense of smell. He was also a missionary kid. He found ways to train himself in mental patience, took power naps instead of indulging in periods of long sleep, boy, I've been doing that lately, and drank very little liquid. He trained himself to accept these abstinences in order to endure the most appalling fatigues, hunger, thirst, and wounds, so that when scouting or traveling where there was no water, he might still be able to exist. On more than one occasion, he survived in environments where others would have died, and were in fact dying of exhaustion. To him, scouting was as exact a study as is the piano to a musician, and it was said that he could read the face of nature as easily as most could read their morning newspaper. He was quiet-mannered and courteous, according to contemporaries. The reports describe a man who was neither shy nor self-conscious, who was extremely modest, and who seldom spoke of his many adventures. Isn't that... I wish there were more men like this. I mean, I could keep going on. This guy just got tons of stuff. He had a brother who had one leg who did all this stuff with him, too. His brother lost a leg as a youth. It's not really saying how in a mining accident. And his brother had a peg leg and joined him in many of these things. Now, of course... Burnham died at age 86, September 1st, 1947, of heart failure. And remember, he was serving as a spy in World War II. So shortly after that war, he died in Santa Barbara. At a private ceremony, he was buried at Three Rivers, California, near his old cattle ranch, La Cuesta. His memorial stone was designed by his only surviving child, Roderick. Also buried at Three Rivers Cemetery is his first wife, Blanche Blick Burnham. Several members of the Blick family, who also pioneered in the 19th century Rhodesia with Burnham for a time, his son Roderick, his granddaughter Martha Burnham Burleigh, and the Montana cowboy Pete Ingram, who survived the Shangani Patrol massacre along with Burnham. Now, his stone, it's a monolith, and it's the only one there. It's a big black monolith, and with brass plates on it depicting everything he did around the base of it, and then his family's laid out there. Now, you may say, why wasn't this guy better noted? Why haven't we heard of this man? Well, they tried, but it was like, I don't know, serendipity kicked in, whatever, and things never came to fruition other than Indiana Jones. And there was one movie that we're trying to find that I'll mention later called The Shangani Patrol, made in 1970 by David Millen, but we can't... Lou spent several hours trying to find it because we want to get it. Now, Ernest Hemingway acquired the rights to produce a film version of Scouting on Two Continents, which is a book that he wrote, Frederick Burnham wrote. He's written several books, and I suggest you get them because they have basic field craft knowledge in them. CBS immediately contracted Hemingway to produce the film for television with Gary Cooper playing the lead role, but Hemingway committed suicide before the film could be started. Burnham was portrayed by Will Hutchin in the movie Shangani Patrol, a feature film by David Millen filmed on location in Bulawayo, Rhodesia, by RPM Film Studios. And now there are 35mm copies of this film out, and we're trying to find it. It was a South African production, so it's going to be kind of hard to find. Now, in 1933, the newly discovered Cerbulodon burnhamani, now it's an extinct elephant, has been named after Burnham, officially named the Burnham elephant. Union Oil was the official sponsor of the Major Burnham Bowling Trophy, an annual bowling event supported by Boy Scouts of America. On My Honor, an epic film conceived and begun by Cecil B. DeMille, was never finished, made about him, about the Boy Scouts, and it's going to mention him in there. Let's see. Starting in 2001, producers Jerry Mullen and Robert Starling began work to finish the project, but it has yet been finished. So hopefully they'll make something about him. And then here's the part that I really like. Writer Haggard's fictional Alan Quatermain, remember him? Character was heavily influenced by his close friendship with Burnham. Quartermain and Burnham were both small and wiry. Victorian adventurers in colonial Africa, both sought and discovered ancient treasures and civilizations. Both battled large wild animals and native peoples. Both were renowned for their ability to track, even at night, and both men were strikingly similar nicknames. Quartermain, Watcher by Night. Burnham, He Who Sees in the Dark. But Burnham's influence on fictional adventurers wasn't to end there. In the 1970s, a young movie director named George Lucas decided to write the ultimate adventure film and templated his hero on Frederick Burnham as Indiana Jones. So this guy, I mean, he found like all kinds of ancient cultures in Africa that didn't, you know, nobody knew about. And I just don't see people like this today anywhere. And I haven't even told you half of it. I mean, there's so much more information on this guy. And he's buried. I can almost see the cemetery from here. It's on the other side of the valley here. Actually, I can't see it because it's more over that way, Honolulu. But, and I don't know if any of his family's still here. I'm going to look them up. I'm going to try and find them. But you just don't see men like that today. You know, and what has happened to our world? Well, one, think about it. If I were in shape and had the ability and just hauled off and ran to Africa and started working as an individual for a foreign government, what would happen to me? What would happen to me? Twinkle Toes is saying we need to move him to our cemetery. It's the whole family plot there. I think they'd be a little mad. But, yeah, he deserves to be buried in a cemetery of honor, not that one. We would definitely pay better attention to him and keep his grave better than they are doing over there. I can tell you that much. There are no more worlds left to conquer, as Alexander said when he peered into India. You know, people talk about the moon and Mars and stuff like that. But I think the situation makes the man. And we probably have many people today that had the potential to be great men, like Frederick Russell Burnham. But the world destroys them. We train our little boys to be effeminate. We take aggressive sports and games out of the schoolyard. Now, this guy, one of the things he had going for him is he dropped out of school. 14 years old or earlier, probably between 12 and 14. You know, what would have happened if Lou had looked at me and said, oh, you're moving back to Colorado? Well, I'm going to stay here and make it on my own. CPS would come and swoop him up and put him in a foster home. Right? The way our societies have developed destroy greatness. I see Freedom said he was in Boy Scouts for 7 years, and there was not enough emphasis on what Frederick did. How much that would have made more of an impact on all, yeah. I don't know much about scouting. I was an Explorer Scout, which is law enforcement, and we didn't talk about field craft or anything, unfortunately. But it should be emphasized in scouting. Now, I know people that are involved in scouting, and I emailed them. I said, you need to find out more about this guy and teach it to your scouts. I want to do a lot more about this guy. Find out, you know, maybe try and get the local authorities to have a special day for him, like on his birthday or the memorial of when he died or something. We need to honor men like this. We need to honor the deeds of great men like this. I may not agree with them. You know, I definitely don't agree with the stand that he took in the Boer Wars. But you can't fault him on it. There are pictures of him I found where he's with Winston Churchill at the Great Pyramids in Giza. You know, this guy was a 12-year-old homeless kid whose father died, no education, and look what he made of himself. He made, I didn't even go into how rich he got off of oil and natural resources because he learned geology and how to identify precious metals and things and scout. Like they said, he could read the terrain. No, not today. Not today. We've destroyed that pioneer attitude. We've destroyed manhood in our culture and in the entire world. We look at stuff like Australia and things and go, oh, wouldn't that be great? But this guy would laugh at every one of our modern cultures. He'd be like, what do you mean I can't just go off into the wilderness and live? What do you mean I can't go claim that mountain for myself and explore it? You know? Somebody causes his daughter to die. He hunts him down, crawls on his belly, sneaks into a cave, waits for him. The moron comes in and does some tribal immunity dance, and he shoots him in the chest and walks away. I love that kind of stuff. You couldn't make this up. You couldn't make this up. This guy lived this. And from all the accounts, there's no bloviating. There's nobody going, no, that wasn't true. Everything stands on its own because everything he did had lots of witnesses. Even the one attack where he was one of only three survivors, there were two other men that said, yeah, it was brutal. We got out by the skin of our teeth. We had to ford a raging river to get away from these lunatic, savage Africans that were, you know, killing and eating our comrades. Good examples of what a person can do with their lives. I've seen countless people go through college and not know what to do. I See Freedom says, yeah. Life experience versus education, folks. Life experience. And I don't hold a candle to this guy, but I've spent my whole life jumping on things and looking for things to do that are exciting and getting involved. And I've probably stretched the limits of what modern society will allow me to do, and I've broken a few. I've pushed the envelope and ended up in jail, ended up on some lists. But what I've done is nothing compared to what this guy did. And I'm pushing the limits. In less than 150 years, from the time he was born in the 1860s, I forgot the exact date, to when he died in 1947, look at how much freedom we've lost. What the difference it means to be a man now compared to what he was. His wife died, and then he married his secretary a few years later. I don't know if she's not buried up there. I think she's buried in Pasadena. But his whole family's with him up there. Friends. People he went through wars with. People. He almost died several times from his wounds. And they kept putting him together. And what did he do? He didn't sit back and collect a pension. He kept fighting. So remember men like Frederick Russell Burnham. That's who I'm remembering on Memorial Day from now on. I may not have fought in the American military. I may not have fought on the sides that I would have liked. But that's a real man. And you need to explore more about it. If you know any scouts, tell them about them. Frederick Russell Burnham. B-U-R-N-H-A-M. I am Dutch Jones. We're only doing an hour today because we got Bible study tonight. Thank you for listening to Stronghold Radio. If you can help us out financially, please do so at dutchjones.info at the main page. Your help is needed. Thank you, Olima. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Thank you to the pod people. And God bless you and all you do in the holy cause of liberty. And let's change our mindset. Let's try to be a little bit more like Frederick Russell Burnham every chance we can, regardless of what they tell us we can't do. Good night, and have a pleasant tomorrow.